Manuel Buttigieg u liem għawċi jil-għawl s-semija ta' Campus 103.7 fejn għal-darbohra fuq taħdi ta' Clio għanna maħna bi pjaċir l-professur Eleanor Sherry u l-professur Nicolas Vella u sarin komplu n-diskutu il-tema l-badna l-ġimma l-ohra maħħom dwar il-prezenza tal-ewel bnedmin f-Malta li ħarġet appuntu mir-riċerka li huma ippubblikaw fil-ġurnal Nature. Eleanor, Nicolas, thank you for joining us again. Last week, we began exploring this absolutely fascinating study that you've published and some of the insights and questions that it raises, and we're going to keep developing some of those with you. What I wanted to kick off with is whether you think that it's possible to find any connection between now the new first people that you've found and the older people that we knew were here, the farmers. There's a distance of 1,000 years, no, we're saying. Is it possible to know if there's a continuity or is it more a case of breaks and comings and goings, kind of like we were saying last week?
We know from Sicily that when the first farmers arrived on Sicily, there was a degree of mixing between the sort of indigenous hunter-gatherers and the newly arrived farmers. But it wasn't a huge amount of mixing. And there was almost certainly some sort of competition over resources as well. We don't know what the situation is in Malta. If, you know, DNA is something that may be able to help us answer that question, because hunter-gatherer DNA is very different to the DNA of the first farmers. So the first farmers come out of the Middle East. They look different. They have very different genetic patterns. Whereas, you know, the people on Malta, these Mesolithic hunter-gatherers, were sort of the survivors of Ice Age Europe. You know, these were sort of indigenous Europeans, the sort of last of the Upper Paleolithic people who had been in Europe in various forms since about, you know, 30,000 years ago.
All right.
So very deeply rooted in these areas. But what we can say is that the first farmers to arrive on Malta, if they didn't see or meet with these hunter-gatherers, they would have known that they were there. They would have known that they were not the first people to be on Malta. They would have seen the residues of the camps. They would have seen the remnants of the fireplaces. They would have known
really?
That they were not the first.
Okay, so the hunter-gatherers would have left enough of an impact on the landscape.
Yeah, so archaeologically from Latnia, the transition to the Neolithic and to the Mesolithic is, you know, these people were standing in the dust of the Mesolithic people. Just
right.
Very, very close in time.
Because perhaps this is something that has not maybe been focused on as much. It's not the case that this site, Latnia, is just about the hunter-gatherers. You have subsequent populations.
Yes, there's every population represented, you know, Romans, Phoenicians, you know, everybody was there. It's a multi-period site.
Because if it's a good site, why waste it, no?
Yes, because you've got a roof on your head.
Uh-huh.
And it's
so it goes
fantastically
all
located.
The way to the Roman times. So sorry,
yes. There is pottery to show that there is a presence. But we're not dealing with a presence that requires you to build anything.
Of course.
You don't have to, because you've got an amazing roof, which is giving you the shelter that you need.
Uh-huh.
And the site is, as many of you who have been there know, You fall on it, as it were. It's hardly visible. It's beautifully camouflaged.
Mm.
It's well protected. It's perfect. You've got the sun hitting a particular spot, which is where we found the evidence for the Mesolithic activity. But of course, the rest of the site will have been used too. And in fact, where we dug other sondages, the evidence is there.
And as you can, from what you can tell, there's part of this roof that at some point collapses.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Is that collapse which helps to preserve this amazing record?
Yes. The deposit is precious there because, as Eleanor said in the other program, it's like a sump. The deposit ended up there. And it stayed there. As we know, in Malta, there's a lot of shifting of soil to create artificial fields.
Yeah.
In this case, it would have been a hell of a job to do that.
So nobody tried.
But in actual fact, there is evidence for a collapse of the roof in sizable blocks, but even in smaller blocks, that actually seals the mesolithic layers.
Like a time
capsule. So that's a time capsule, and it preserved it beautifully, which meant that if anybody was plowing there in later years, because from the 1850s onwards, the whole of the north of Malta was given over for improvement, by the British, in that spot, there was no attempt to do that because you are hitting rock.
Yeah.
And therefore, it helped preserve anything that lay below in this particular spot of the cave, because the cave has a different type of floor level. It's got terracing. It will be interesting to find out how old the terracing is. And the split levels reveal different ages. And this is quite interesting and quite exciting.
Now, I would like to go into the question of the maritime crossing. How did it happen? Why did it happen? And obviously, we know that they came via the sea because that's the only way humans can arrive on the island.
Yes.
How? Why? When?
when I think we answered so far.
So far.
When we answered. So why is something that we need to look at things from the Sicilian story.
Okay.
And I don't think we have probably sufficient evidence to be definite about it, whether the last hunter-gatherers were pushed by the earliest farmers on Sicily.
So this could be a possibility they're escaping.
Well, possibly.
But there could be some sort of domino effect going further north. So the further north you go, up what is today Italy, the older the Neolithic becomes. So the first Neolithic farmers, the first ones arrived in the northern areas first and then pushed down to the south.
Right.
So obviously, like, farming is extremely old in the Middle East. It's like 11,000 years old, and, you know, it's 7,500 years old by the time it comes to Malta. So it takes time for farming to spread. But obviously, when farmers arrive, they start working land. And then if the population increases, they need to find other land. So they need to move and find new land. And obviously, that has certain push effects. Mm-hmm. If you have hunter-gatherers in that landscape as well. So it could be, you know, northern hunter-gatherers have to move further south. And then it has a domino effect on the hunter-gatherers further south than that, and there could be a whole pushing effect that ends in Malta.
Yes.
Right. Wow.
From the closest land area, which is the Ragusano in Sicily,
yes,
where the Maltese islands would have been visible on clear days, just like they are visible today without using any magnification of any sort.
Yeah.
The islands are visible, and then a question of how you're going to cross the minimum 85 kilometers off sea between Sicily and Malta, or perhaps the closest, which would be Gozo. We go by the evidence that is available, and the evidence that is available from central Italy, north of Rome, is evidence in the shape of dugout canoes of about 10 meters in length, made from oak, which go back to the early Neolithic. That is the date we have for these dugouts from the site called Lago di Bracciano, it was always thought that these dugouts would be suitable for use on the lake because that is where they were found.
Mm.
But a person years ago now, in the 90s, tried out an experiment where they filled a trunk just under what the original would have been at Lago di Bracciano, just under 10 meters, and they dug out a canoe and they tried it out, not in a lake environment, but in different parts of the Mediterranean, including the Straits of Messina, southern Italy, Liguria.
Which is very difficult to navigate. The Straits of Messina are impossible to navigate.
But they managed with 10 people paddling and one at the back who was the steersman using a steering oar, which was found at Lago di Bracciano, and they managed with distances of 50 kilometers, even in 2 meter waves, and even in conditions with strong currents. They tried this out on the south of France, south of Spain, in different parts of the Med.
To get to Malta would have involved a nighttime crossing.
Yes, exactly.
And this is a nighttime crossing means you suddenly lose the vision of Malta from Sicily.
Yes, but there's a sky which presumably
they knew about. This brings me to the question: if these guys were sailing,
equal opportunities.
Yes.
Okay. These guys in a generic way,
and their tortoise. So they had to have a knowledge of navigation.
I prefer to call it wayfinding, because navigation in the literature refers to somebody who is using a map. In other words, a 2D representation of space, not necessarily on paper, but that is what navigation implies. This is wayfinding, and wayfinding means that you know that there is land because you can see it.
Number one, and number two is.
Even the migratory birds are telling you in which direction land is. The problem is not when you are on high ground and you know that there is land, but when you are on the boat, level with the sea, in summer, where the haze might not be ideal. When am I saying summer? Because summer is usually where you get the maximum daylight. No? Which doesn't mean that these people would have preferred summer over perhaps spring if the conditions were right to manage such a crossing. As I said, because the maximum that has been tried out experimentally is 50 kilometers, it means that anything over 50, which implies spending time out at sea during the dark, it's a big undertaking. And this is where we start realizing what is involved over here. Together with a colleague of mine, Gianmarco Alberti, from the Faculty of Social Wellbeing, we are trying to gather the ethnographic information and trying to model the likely routes that could have been taken in the Sicily-Malta Channel. And the results that we're getting is that in one way it would have made sense leaving from one spot, but the other way, Malta-Sicily, would have been more difficult because of the currents that exist in this part of the Mediterranean, assuming that the currents have not changed since then. We know that the winds have certainly not changed since people have been writing about the conditions of navigation in the central Mediterranean. Greek and Roman sources make it clear that we're looking at the same pattern. Of course, further back, it's a little bit more, trickier. But look, in other parts of the world, it's a 1,000-mile journey can be done. The only difference is that you have outrigger with sails. And for the Mediterranean, the sail appears in the Eastern Mediterranean in an altogether different period. In Egypt, in the Bronze Age.
Or power. Yes.
So this is all powered paddling.
And this brings me the question of, they need to have food with them. And hunter-gatherers, are they preserving the meat?
Water definitely is the most important.
Yeah, water is the most important.
Water and food, yeah. I mean,
and there's no pottery, so.
No, but you can carry stuff
in skins. In bamboo sticks.
In skins.
Baskets,
etc.
So they probably had things like... I mean, we know at this time they were weaving fish traps and things like that.
Yes,
so,
of course.
They had basketry and things like that. And you can preserve the meat by smoking, salting.
So they had this kind of technology.
Yes, probably. Well, yeah. Yes.
But to make such a crossing feasible, I can't imagine just one boat with 10 people. Would you have had a small flotilla to actually make it feasible? Because, if one boat capsizes, that's it. But maybe you have 10 boats and five capsize.
The capsizing element is something that does not worry me too much. Because somebody who can read the weather conditions well will be able to tell whether it would be feasible to venture out. Right. We have from ethnographic stories, even from a relatively recent past, a crew will be put together if the padrone will say, and from Marsha Schlock, that the weather is right to head out to Sicily on a mission. And you would rally the crew from Asha, you would rally the crew from Zeytoun, etc. And you head out because, you know, you can read the weather conditions. I don't assume that this sort of intimate knowledge of what the environment can afford would not have been available to people like that. Who always depend on the environment for certainly for sustenance, for surviving.
Much more than us.
Much more than us, because if there's an element of food production with the farmers, in this case, no, you need to know what things are. And the risk, the being able to take the risk and make it worth the while, is something that they would have lived with.
In my mind, somehow hunter-gatherers are always land-based. That's how I picture them. So the fact that they're undertaking this and they're showing this kind of navigational maritime knowledge, to me, it's just astounding. It's changing. And how deeply does it change perspectives?
I mean, in fact, the late Mesolithic, which is what this belongs to, is a very, very interesting period for very different reasons. So there's lots of things like fish trap technologies, maritime technologies appearing during this time. And all across the Mediterranean, there's evidence that Mesolithic people are really exploiting maritime resources. So it's, some people call the late Mesolithic the shellfish Mesolithic, because everywhere you find like tons and tons of shellfish. So there's obviously something going on. And some colleagues have sort of argued that after the last cold snap in the Younger Dryas, this sort of precipitates some kind of like seafaring capabilities, and this may even relate to the fact that, you know, you have rapid sea level rise after the last glaciation, so people are almost forced to engage with the sea because the sea is coming for them and they have to, you know, rapidly move inland. So there's all sorts of reasons which make it really interesting. But to me, like, a major emerging question is, you know, this assumption that farmers arrive and they have all these maritime capabilities, it could very easily be that they actually learn them from the Mesolithic people and not the other way around, and then ended up using that to spread the Neolithic very rapidly along the coastline, which is one route of Neolithic dispersal.
Sea travel is much faster.
In fact, the experiment with the canoes that I mentioned earlier was undertaken to prove that using canoes of that sort, it was possible to travel distances and diffuse, as it were, the technology, agricultural package. That was the intention. Over here, now, all of a sudden, because of what we found, we're trying to reflect on the use of that technology for the Mediterranean earlier. Because there's no way that humans could have come over to Malta at the time, if not by boat.
By boat, of course.
On Seacraft.
I want to link up to something that, Eleanor, you mentioned in the previous episode, where you said that in general, when humans appear somewhere, it seems that animal populations collapse.
Yeah.
Now, does your research indicate that something like that is happening with these hunter-gatherers? Do they deplete local stocks of animals? Maybe not so much the sea resources, but the land resources. And does that in turn doom them? Because if the hunter-gatherers eat everything and they're stuck here, then what do you do?
Yeah. What's really interesting about the case of Malta is, like, two things stand out to me. So first of all, as we mentioned in the last episode, hunter-gatherers are by nature immobile. It's a mobile lifestyle. And in semi-arid places, for example, in Africa, you can see people spreading out many hundreds of kilometers in order to gather and hunt enough food. Obviously, in Malta, they can't do that.
No.
Malta almost forces a more sedentary condition on hunter-gatherers, because they are very limited in how far they can spread out. It's a really, really small island, and it would have been back then too. So that's really interesting. And it's sort of... It's going to go one way or another. If you're sort of concentrated in a small area, you're either going to deplete everything very, very quickly, or you're going to be forced to develop a strategy that would allow you to maximize those resources and not overdo it. And obviously, in human history, we see examples of people doing both of these things. It seems that our hunter-gatherers in Malta were very good at planning and husbanding their resources. So they don't seem to kill everything in sight. So Malta has a small population of endemic red deer. They're highly inbred. And if they would have wanted to hunt them to extinction, they could have done it very, very quickly.
Right.
But it very much looks like these animals survive into the period when the farmers are starting to arrive. So, you know, they are being careful. And the reason I think they're exploiting things like lots of birds, and they have a very diverse diet, which also includes, you know, maritime resources, showing they're sort of spreading out their resources, probably with different seasons.
A sustainable approach.
It's a very sustainable approach. Yeah, exactly.
That's fascinating. You know,
yeah, it's absolutely fascinating.
A huge amount of organizational ability on their part.
It shows an enormous knowledge of their ecosystems, their surroundings, animal behavior, forward planning. And of course, if you stitch that together with the maritime knowledge and all the sophisticated maritime knowledge they would have had to come here to build the boats, all of that involves points to, like, you know, an incredibly sophisticated and interesting culture. That, you know, really flies in the face of any remaining stereotypes of cavemen.
Yeah.
Yes.
There is correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to be true that a hunter-gatherer, broadly speaking, has a better diet than a sedentary farming population, because one has variety and the other doesn't. So I'm assuming if they're so good at mixing, that's giving them a certain resilience as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, studies comparing sort of late hunter-gatherers, even some of the earliest farmers with later farming communities, you know, there's a loss of stature and you see like more things like dental caries, problems on the bones. But, you know, a hunter-gatherer lifestyle is also not an easy one either, so depending on where you are and what animals you had to hunt.
So you do not suggest that listeners change to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle?
Well, there is a paleo diet,
yeah,
apparently.
We're again nearing the end. It's all flying by. But we have this. What's the future? What are you intrigued about? What are you going to bring to the table to Malta's history?
Because Nick, you're always saying this is just the beginning.
just the beginning.
Il gira du jay, yeah, Fede Portelli.
Because we have dug, but. Of course, we have to keep on digging, not necessarily deeper, but even
wider,
because the nature of the excavation is what it is. You need to make sure that if you decide to go deeper, that there are safety concerns that you have to keep in mind, etc., etc., etc. And the most important thing to keep in mind here for listeners to your program, but generally is the amount of time it takes to go from the digging, which happens once a year over 4 weeks, to processing all the finds by specialists, who are knowledgeable about specific areas. And this takes ages.
Yeah.
It's amazing that in fact in the space of a few years we could come up with these results, because there are people who are committed to just the research.
Can we say a word about the different specializations that have been involved in something like this and will be involved? So. Yes. What kind of
there are so many. I think, Nick, you're going to have to help me out here because I won't remember all of them. So we have various different people looking at isotope chemistry. So this, for example, strontium isotopes will tell you where a person or an animal grew up. Whereas like other oxygen and nitrogen will shed light on, for example, how much tree cover you had, things like that. We're looking at pollen to reconstruct the environment. We've also got plant macrobotanical remains like seeds. We're looking at the charcoal to see what plants are being burned for fuel. And the answer to that is things like palms and pistachio, so lentisk tree bushes. We are doing ancient DNA, not just from bones, but also from sediments, and not just people, but also animals. So, for example, what's the story of the Maltese endemic deer? Like, where did they come from? Where's their place in the phylogeny of European deer? Because, you know, deer are not African. They have to have come from Europe.
Okay.
What else, Nick? We're looking at phytoliths, which are siliceous plant remains found in the soil. And for example, we compare the general phytoliths in the soil with the ones found in hearths, the ones that get burnt, to see if there's any differences. So then you can draw conclusions about fuel. There's like chemical analyses on the hearth itself to reconstruct burning temperatures, because human fires burn at different temperatures to wildfires. We are, you know, if we get human DNA, we'll also look at pathogens as well as ancestry.
Have we found human remains?
Last season we found a finger bone.
Okay.
Yep, just a finger bone. And yeah, so obviously there's all the radiocarbon dating.
Must have been an amputation
or we're calling it Frodo.
Frodo.
So what else? So we are. You've got all the dating programs, so we date the charcoal, we date bone where we can if there's collagen preservation, and also dating the marine gastropods, but that's really complicated because they absorb more carbon than other things, so you have to do something called a marine reservoir connection, so that's its own like project. And then obviously there's all the modeling, the mathematical modeling on the dates to look at the likelihoods of the date distributions being the right ones. All the zoo archaeology, the standard zoo archaeology studies, the lithic studies of the stone tools, but later periods, yes. Pottery, trying to date pottery directly as well, sort of experimenting with that a little bit.
So there's more of you researching than probably where hunter-gatherers on the spot.
I think so.
Yeah, there's certainly like a lot of analyses going on. We struggle to remember all of them.
Yeah. For those who we have forgotten, excuse us. Thank you for your contribution to this amazing.
If you want, you're always welcome on the program.
Yes. Again, thank you. It was so interesting, surely for both of us and much more importantly for our listeners who have been asking us to get in touch with these two who have been challenging our historical norms and
rewriting the
history books. and we were so happy to have you. Thank you once again.
Thank you.
On behalf of Manuel Buttigieg, I'm Liam Gauci. We'll meet you next week. Thank you.